I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Weekend violence in Iraq has pushed the number of American soldiers killed there to over 1,700. A spokesman for the Iraqi government says that in the same period, they estimate that 12,000 Iraqis, most of them civilians, have also been killed. Here in this country, popular support for this war continues to drop. A North Carolina Republican congressman says he's planning to introduce a bill that will set a firm timetable for U.S. withdrawal. Meanwhile, in Iraq, there have been some hints that some of the insurgents are willing to join the political process. And today on the program, that's where we want to focus our attention. Can Iraqi politics bring an end to Iraq's violence? Can the different factions and tribes work out a formula that persuades all sides to put away the weapons and concentrate on rebuilding? And is that a formula that's going to be found in a new constitution? Furthermore, can Iraq do this on its own without U.S. involvement? We'd like to hear from you. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're starting today in Baghdad. Patrick McDonnell is a Baghdad bureau chief with the Los Angeles Times, and he's joining us on a line from there. Hello, Patrick.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine. There's a little bit of crackle on your line, so I'll ask you to speak a little bit slowly, if you would. Tell me, if you can, Patrick, what's the latest on this talk from Sunni extremists that, in fact, they want in on the political process? Is that real?
Well, in truth, here it feels rather vague. It's clear that there have been some feelers made from people in the Sunni Arab insurgency to the U.S. embassy, to kind of moderate Sunnis, but what exactly they're willing to relinquish in return for some piece of the political process remains very vague, and the contacts with the Americans have been very back-channel and not direct, and there's many, many issues to be resolved before that really critically masses.
Tell me, Patrick, why it is that the spokespeople for the extremists would go through the Americans in Iraq. Why wouldn't they go straight to the government and talk with either President Talabani's people or Prime Minister Jafri?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons for that. One of them being that they have indeed made entreaties to people in the government, and some of those people in the government are indeed the intermediaries who contacted the Americans. And another reality here is that there is 140,000 or so U.S. troops on the ground who are essentially a bulwark against the Sunni Arab militants who are fighting the insurgency, and they are, and those U.S. troops are the strongest military power here still, and therefore it would be natural that they would, if they were interested in some kind of a deal or compromise, they would try to some kind of back channel contact with the Americans. So it's pretty logical.
Patrick, just help me with one other thing. There's all this talk in the newspapers here about a struggle for a number of seats on a committee that will draft the Constitution. Is that the way in for the Sunnis to raise their profile on that committee to get more say in what exactly is included in the new Constitution?
No, I'm sure in the States that sounds very in-house and probably difficult to comprehend, but essentially, I mean, the American strategy here, as much as anything, which the Iraqi government has endorsed, is essentially to kind of bring the Sunni Arabs away from the armed insurgency and bring them into the political process. The next big thing that happens with the political process is the writing of the Constitution. The Constitutional Committee, which only includes a handful of Sunni Arabs, of course, it's upset the Sunni Arabs, although the reason it includes so few is that very few voted. But anyway, the dominant Shia and Kurds have agreed to bring more Sunni Arabs into the Constitution Writing Committee, and right now there's kind of a deadlock or an impasse over how many Sunni Arabs will be brought in and what their exact role will be. So it sounds kind of in-house and technical, but really it's very important. The Constitution has to be a consensus document. Otherwise, it could just further alienate Sunni Arabs. So it's a behind-the-scenes discussion, but the outcome is very significant and important if indeed this strategy is to have any legs, this strategy of bringing the Sunni Arabs into the political process and kind of turning them away from armed militancy.
Quick last question, if I can, Patrick, and that is that, of course, we continue to see the headlines here in the U.S. about the bombs that are taking out Iraqi policemen, that are threatening American servicemen, the discoveries of all the shallow graves, some 28 bodies over the weekend. If you're just to talk to Iraqis today in Baghdad about what's important, are they still consumed with the news of the insurgency, or are they talking about this kind of political inside stuff we're talking about?
People in Iraq in general are very, very consumed with the issue of security. They always have been. They don't feel secure. The nation feels very insecure. And very few families, in particularly in the Sunni areas of Iraq, haven't lost someone or don't know someone who's lost someone in this very, very kind of bitter and bloody struggle. So they're very concerned with security. To the extent that a political settlement can increase security, they're very interested in a political settlement. However, there's a lot of frustration with the time it's taken from the elections on January 30th, number one, to form a government, which took 3 months, and now we have this kind of somewhat protracted discussion over this committee to name a constitution. And there's a lot of frustration with the time all of these parliamentary discussions are taken.
Patrick, I thank you so much for your time.
You're very welcome.
That's Patrick McDonald, he is one of the Baghdad bureau chiefs for the Los Angeles Times, joining us live on the line from there. And joining us on the program now, two men who have both had a hand in this very process. They both worked in Baghdad with Iraqis and Americans trying to get a constitution written. Noah Feldman is a law professor at New York University and author of What We Owe Iraq, War and the Ethics of Nation Building. Larry Diamond is a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. He's just had a new book published. It's called Squandered Victory, The American Occupation and the Bungled Effort to Bring Democracy to Iraq. Now, they're both in our New York studio, which just lost power, and so they have both brought out their cell phones and they're joining us by cell phone. We hope to get the studio power back shortly. But first of all, Noah, thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure, and at least we're not on satellite phones.
we'll do a measure of quality later. Larry, thanks to you also for joining us.
Good morning.
And Larry, let me just start with you. I'm curious to know how much importance you attach to this news that there's this a little bit of a coming together, a hint from the insurgents that they're interested in being part of the political process.
Well, they've been hinting for a year and a half. People at the United Nations have been telling us, others have been telling us that people, at least associated with the insurgency, want to talk to the United States. And I think that we have to understand there are many components to the insurgency. Some of them are relentless dead-enders who have no vision of any kind of political system that would involve the rule of law and democracy. But a number of them are, I think, willing to talk and perhaps increasingly realizing that they're not going to come back to rule and that there may be a place for them in a political system where they will have a significant share of power, but they will not dominate.
And Noah, do you see this as their acceptance that maybe the kind of insurgency that they've been involved with is not going to win them the aims that they may originally have hoped for?
I think we're still pretty far from their actually accepting that. I think right now what you're seeing is a split strategy where some Sunnis will continue with the violent part of the insurgency. Other Sunnis, and perhaps in some cases some of the same people, will come to the table and negotiate, and they can pursue both of these tracks simultaneously, as we've seen elsewhere in the world, where, for example, in Palestine, violence can continue and negotiations at the same time.
And Larry, if I can come back to the point that you're making about the gestures of looking for a way in. You wrote a memo about that in December of 2003 when you were beginning your work with the Coalition Provisional Authority. Why is it that the United States and the interim Iraqi politicians never picked up on these offers of some kind of political conversation?
Well, we did begin to pick up much later, I'd say, especially since the handover of power last June. But again, tentatively, and not in a very focused and systematic way. I think that there are three reasons. The initial reason, I think, had a lot to do with the kind of macho attitude of this administration when the president basically said to the terrorists, bring it on, and they did. You know, we're the United States, we're not going to be messed with. I think a second reason was that there was concern on the part of a lot of people that we would look weak if we started talking to these people, and we might further encourage them.
The U.S. would look weak, is what you mean.
Yes, the United States of America. And the third reason is that a number of elements of what are now members of the transitional government have a kind of more hardline attitude where they're not particularly interested in talking either, but, you know, would really like to crush these people who had been crushing and suppressing the Shia and the Kurds for so many decades. Now, I don't think that that represents the view of the Prime Minister, Ibrahim Jaafari, or of the Kurdish political leaders, but there is this sentiment within the transitional government.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Regardless of what happens in Iraq, in Baghdad, Iraqi politics is never going to move any further ahead unless all sides are a part of the process. Question is, are we beginning to see that now with conversations and requests from the Sunni side for a greater involvement in drafting the constitution? Is that perhaps the way that the violence in that country is most likely to end? We'd like to hear from you. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Larry Diamond and Noah Feldman were both senior advisors to the Coalition Provisional Authority in Baghdad, helping to try and bring Iraqis and Americans there a little bit closer to a constitution towards some kind of political resolution. Noah Feldman went to Baghdad when the city itself was still smoldering in the summer of 2003. Larry Diamond left a little over a year ago. Now he was in after Noah, working with both sides there. And they're here because this hour we're talking about the options for a political settlement in Iraq. The last few days have brought us reports that the insurgents are interested in taking part in the political process. How does that work? Will that be an end to the violence? Is that what's going to bring American soldiers home? 1-800-423-TALK. Noah Feldman, how do you bring these people in without being seen to reward the violence that they've been a part of for the past year and a half?
It's extremely delicate because, in essence, we are rewarding the violence. The truth is that if it were not for the violence, there are people, exactly as Larry said, in the Shia and Kurdish sides of the government who would have preferred not to speak to the Sunnis. But the reality is, if they want to have a country that works, they've got to get all three of the major groups back to the table. And the Sunnis have made that very clear to them through the insurgency. So there is a connection. On the other hand, as a practical matter, the people who will be negotiating, the people who will be joining the constitutional writing body, are not going to be the same exact people who are going to be directly involved in the insurgency. And I think the goal should be to create a gap between them, to encourage a situation where there is a credible and real Sunni leadership that's a political leadership and not a military leadership. And that would be a big step in that direction.
Now, and Noah, is there the same situation on the Sunni side as we know there is on the Shia side, where there are political leaders, but there are also clerical leaders who are giving the sort of overall direction?
The situation is even more complicated on the Sunni side. On the Shia side, you've got some very broadly agreed upon major religious leaders like Ayatollah Ali Sistani. On the Sunni side, what you've got is a free-for-all. Everyone is trying to pronounce himself a big leader, and the clerics are stepping right into the political gap right now. The absence of a real leadership, the clerics are stepping up and saying, we're the ones who should be in charge. Listen to us. And it remains to be seen if they can actually get Sunnis to listen to them. You know, one of the biggest problems on the Sunni side has been and remains that there is no well-established leadership. So you've got a force of personality situation, as they say, where different people are saying, I'm in charge.
And Larry, in your book, you break the, setting aside al-Qaeda and their own involvement, you break the Sunni down into five different kinds of factions, from old Ba'athists to Muslim scholars and you know, the Islamist parties and so on. Are they ever going to find a leader that can speak for them, or is this part of the problem that the Sunnis speak with so many different voices at the same time?
Well, you see, the Sunnis have never really had to do politics in the way that the Kurds have been doing, for example, because they've been ruling and dominating in a hegemonic way. So, in a way, they're behind the curve, but there are a number of signs, Dick, that have been emerging, I'd say at least since the fall of last year, that they're starting to get their acts together. It's a long, difficult, painful process because, as Noah said, there are so many putative leaders offering themselves. I think it would help an awful lot if there were some dedicated mediation to try and further induce Sunni constituencies to draw together and to get them to become a little bit more realistic in their demands. I think there's a role that the United Nations could play here, working alongside the United States, but at least we're moving in the right direction.
How important is that? Because the UN is providing what's called technical assistance in the drafting of this constitution, but you made a big point about talking about the high profile of Lakhdar Brahimi and his ability to connect with the Shiite clerical leader Ayatollah Sistani. Is it important for the UN to play that honest broker in Iraq? Would they be accepted in that role?
Well, there is a UN mission there that goes beyond technical assistance, important as that is, but I don't think it's at a high enough level now to have an impact. We saw repeatedly in Iraq, when Brahimi was there on both of his missions, an ability to cut through a lot of the political stalemate very elegantly and, I'd say, shrewdly navigate between these disparate factions and competing political and ideological visions and craft some kind of consensus. And I think the United States is not sufficiently trusted in Iraq to do that, certainly to do that alone. We need some more neutral arbiter, and I think the UN is our best prospect.
And are the U.S. People there ready to let the UN take that on, or is there still a little bit no, we want to be in front, no, you can be in front?
Well, you're going to have to ask the Bush administration that, but I think the administration has been very sobered by the difficulties of the last number of months, and we called on the UN to perform a very specific mediating role early in 2004. I don't see in principle why we can't do so again.
You get that as well, Noah? A shift in the administration attitude here? It doesn't matter who's involved, EU, UN, let's just get it done.
I agree with Larry that each time we've been in trouble, the administration has been willing to go to the UN when they had no other choice, and this may be one of those times. On the other hand, I'm less convinced that the Iraqis themselves are prepared, at least in the constitutional process, to be sympathetic to anyone meddling in how they're going to do things. That includes the UN. The Iraqis themselves are very committed to this thought that this constitution, unlike the interim constitution, should be a wholly Iraqi document produced by Iraqis and for Iraqis. Whether that turns out to be the case or not, it needs to look like it's the case to many Iraqis. And so I think a prominent role for the United Nations at this point would actually be a risky one, and I think there will be a lot of resistance from Iraqi politicians who have, after all, now been elected to speak for their constituencies and are not open to the idea that someone will appear to be coming in and saying, oh, well, maybe this is the way you should do it.
There's something that you wrote about a while back, Noah, on your trip to Baghdad in the summer of 2003, which seems to me relevant here, and that is the person who came up to you and asked the question, who is the government? Not what is the government or who are the people in the government. Who is the government? I guess it's this experience of many years living with one great personality that led the country. This country ever shift away from the importance of personality? So they're talking about issues and power sharing and questions like drafting a constitution.
I believe they can, but the precondition for that is that the government has to actually be able to govern. That means to establish law and order, to sort of make sure that if you're arrested for something, you go to jail, you get a trial and that you go to jail, to protect people in their homes, to protect people on the streets. Without doing that, no government can sort of say, well, we're an ordinary bureaucratic government, now let's talk about drafting the Constitution. The call for personalities is going to continue so long as it appears that in the absence of a personality, nobody's running the show. And so today, if you asked Iraqis who's the government, they would know who the names were. They would know Ibrahim Jafari was the prime minister and Jalal Talabani was the president, but they would say, these guys aren't much of a government at all because we don't feel safe and secure in our own homes. And that fundamental fact, I think, makes it extremely difficult to move away from personalities.
And Larry, when you were there, you had your hands on this transitional administrative law, the TAL, the interim constitution. And I get the impression that, you know, had it been explained properly and if the timing of that had been a little bit better managed, Iraqis might have made that kind of a shift. Is that a reasonable way of looking at it?
Not entirely. The problem with the transitional administrative law was that Iraqis were not really involved, the Iraqi public was not adequately involved in the discussion of it, the debate over it, and the adoption of it. I think the drafters of it, particularly the lead drafter, Faisal Estrabadi, who's now the deputy permanent representative of Iraq here at the United Nations, did a brilliant job and injected in an admirable way separation of powers and human rights, rule of law provisions into the document that makes it a historic document for the Arab world. But there was not a sense of ownership on the part of the Iraqi people because there had not been time to submit it to them for discussion and to go through a kind of public discourse and educational process. It's very important that that happen in the process of crafting and adopting the permanent constitution. And that is why the transitional administrative law actually requires public debate and dialogue and participation in the drafting of the permanent document. And that is why I feel it is a mistake for us to feel that we must have the permanent constitution adopted by August 15th. If that comes at the price, once again, of exclusion of the Iraqi public from this dialogue, I think that that will be a really unfortunate development for democracy in Iraq.
But Larry, aren't they stuck with that August 15th deadline?
No, they're not. There's a provision that was written into the transitional administrative law that allows the National Assembly to implement a one-time six-month extension of the entire process. So the permanent constitution would then have to be adopted by February 15th, not August 15th, and all the other deadlines would move back 6 months so that the elections would come by June 15th of 2006.
Noah Feldman, what's the risk that that kind of extension would be seen as a failure at the same time, that they couldn't get it done and there'll be another 6 months of chaos?
Well, it's certainly the case that many people will be frustrated when or if, but I think it's probably when, that delay is actually taken. There is going to be some cost associated with it. But on the other hand, it's now the middle of June, and we don't even have the committee of people who are going to write the Constitution. So the idea that the Constitution could actually be written in just a couple of months is really not a realistic one. All that could happen in a couple of months is that they could take the old document, make a few superficial edits to it, and say, okay, now we've got a Constitution. And that won't satisfy those Sunnis we were talking about who want to have an actual say in the process. So I think the odds are very high that we're going to see the delay, that there will be some cost associated with it, but that the benefit of that delay in terms of allowing Iraqis to feel some more meaningful sense of participation in their constitutional process is probably well worth the cost.
You two both know the words that are already on paper in this interim constitution. I'd like to hear from both of you, and Noah, maybe you can start on this. I mean, how much of the heavy lifting has already been done? Have they got the framework for a constitution that they can basically fiddle with, or are they going to have to start all over again?
I believe there's an excellent structure there that, exactly as Larry said, that separates powers between the different branches of government, and that guarantees basic rights, and that incorporates Islam in a way that I think is compatible with democracy and also satisfactory to the senior Islamic figures in the country. So all that's good. The one thing that I think is still really missing is some guarantee in the Constitution that is in the structure of government that would enable minorities, meaning both Kurds and Sunnis, to feel confident that their interests will continue to be represented in the government. And it's very tricky to do that, but one possibility is something like an upper house, like the American Senate or the upper house of Parliament in some other places, that doesn't represent people just on the basis of numbers, but also on the basis of geography. think that might be an assurance to some of the minority groups in Iraq.
Larry, what are your thoughts on this?
No, I think Noah is right in his last observation. The Presidency Council was one institution that was meant implicitly to offer that kind of protection because there are three members to it, and it was presumed, and so far it's been the case, that there would be a Shia, a Sunni, and a Kurd on the Presidency Council. But I agree with Noah that that's not enough. I think there are going to be big debates about federalism, what it should look like, about whether the provisions for Islam in the Constitution are going to be adequate. I don't think the Shiite clergy are satisfied with the way it's framed now in the transitional administrative law. And I think we have huge debates ahead. I like the transitional administrative law in its liberal provisions, but I don't think there's consensus nationally in Iraq on this. And part of the purpose of a national dialogue is to get consensus. One other thing I'd like to underscore is that it's very important that federalism be structured in a way that is more geographic and not ethnic. If the country reverts to a kind of structure in which there's one Kurdish region, one Sunni region, and one or two Shiite regions, that's going to be an extremely fragile and, I think, unfortunate political structure for Iraq.
And if we are, in fact, looking 6, 7, 8 months ahead before there's a constitution, we're also being told, Noah, that at some point in that period of time, the trial of Saddam Hussein could begin. And if that becomes a large public event, I'm wondering if you think that could have a sort of constructive, whether or not it will be constructive or possibly destructive. I mean, on the downside of it, you would have all these Sunnis trying to figure out if they have a place in the government, looking at the person who was once, you know, the head of their party and an important man in the Sunni hierarchy being publicly criticized day after day. Is that a risk in your mind?
It is a risk, and it all depends on how those who are running the trial manage the public aspect of it. So if the trial is seen as Shia and Kurds blaming Sunnis for what happened under Saddam, and then executing Saddam pretty darn quick in order to send a message to the Sunnis, it will deepen the sectarian divisions in the country rather than helping. On the other hand, if, and this is a big if, the prosecutors are able to point out that there were many, many Sunni victims of Saddam, just as there were Shia and Kurdish victims, and then to essentially pretend that the history of Iraq is not the history of Sunnis dominating Shia and Kurds, but rather the history of all Iraqis together being dominated by Saddam, and this would be a creative fiction, but it might be a very useful fiction, then, in fact, the trial could potentially serve as a more unifying and healing device. And that's really the challenge of the prosecution. And that's why it's not just about trial and justice and punishment. It's about the public meaning that is created around the trial.
No, I know you have to go off to a meeting. So just a quick sort of concluding comment from you, if I can get one. Are you in any way encouraged by what you're seeing in Iraq, this talk that there are elements of the extremists or the insurgents who are looking for a political way in? Isn't this what has to happen?
I'm very pleased and relieved that there are now Sunni groups saying they want to participate in the constitutional process, because if they had opted out of the process completely, as they opted out of the election, that would be a way of pretty much guaranteeing the continuation of the insurgency. So what we do have now is an opportunity. But as Larry shows in his excellent book, we've had many opportunities so far in Iraq, and we've squandered a lot of them. So it's pretty important that we not squander this one. And I think what's crucial going forward is to insist, for the U.S. to insist, that the Shia and the Kurds be flexible in the political negotiations, even as we keep up the pressure militarily. Because the military pressure, let's be honest, is one of the reasons that the Sunnis are willing to come to the table. So I'm encouraged, but I'm by no means certain it's all going to go well. And I think optimism is something that I and a lot of the rest of us lost somewhere about 18 months ago.
All right, Noah, thanks for your time. Noah Feldman teaches law at New York University. He has a new book coming out this summer. It's called Divided by God, America's Church-State Problem and What We Should Do About It. And it is in fact, due out next month. Now, Connection listeners, you've been very patient with us. We've worked with cell phones and studios. We should be back with Larry Diamond in a studio to begin the third segment in just a few moments from now. We'd like to hear from you on the questions we're raising here about Iraqi politics solving Iraqi problems. We're at 1-800 423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. And we're asking this hour if, in your opinion, Iraqi politics can bring an end to Iraq's violence. Larry Diamond is with me. He's a senior fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution and served as senior advisor to the Coalition Provisional Authority. He's got a new book out. It's called Squandered Victory, The American Occupation and the Bungled Effort to Bring Democracy to Iraq. And I think we have you on a studio connection now. Am I right, Larry?
We do, and it's a pleasure.
It's good to have you. There's one more point just before I go to the calls that I want to get from you, because I think it's important here, and that is that if we were to simplify the political picture here and simply say, okay, we have Sunni, we have Shia, and we have Kurds, and we have everybody looking for their own interests in whatever an Iraqi federation is going to be, how important is oil, the revenue from oil, the distribution of that?
Oil is a possible lubricating element in a national coalition, and it's a curse. And let me talk about both of those. As a facilitating element, it can enable each of the major groups in Iraq and different geographic elements within them to each have a piece of the pie, each have a share of resources, each see their lives and their communities improving because the oil is flowing again, because there's peace in the country, because the revenue is reasonably well managed and fairly distributed. And that's why federalism is so important to the future of this country. Not only political federalism, but fiscal federalism. So the revenue is not going to just flow into the center and stay there, but some portion of it is going to be devolved down to the different regional, provincial, and local governments. It's a curse because almost everywhere in the developing world where you have substantial oil revenues, you have bad governance, you have massive corruption, you have public cynicism, you have political stability, and you have the constant threat of, human rights violations to protect the oil, military intervention, revolutionary movements, whatever, however they may be framed in the particular national context. And, one thing that the CPA tried to do, I give Ambassador credit for this in my mind and in my book, is implement institutions to improve and protect governance that would last beyond the American occupation of Iraq. We implemented auditors general. We implemented a counter-corruption commission, a strong law in this regard. But the institutions are only as strong as the individuals who are willing to operate them and the national consensus that stands behind them. And I don't think these institutions are really off the ground yet. And I do think we have witnessed in the governing council, in the interim government under Prime Minister Alawi, and now in the transitional government, a lot of the inertia and momentum that develops behind, basically corrupt and clientelistic practices, not everywhere, but certainly incipient again. And if this gets going, this will really disillusion Iraqis about their government and prevent it from accumulating the kind of legitimacy that it needs to really stabilize Iraq.
All right, Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. One reach for that legitimacy is the insurgents coming to the table saying we want a say in the drafting of a constitution. We want a greater role in the politics. After all that's happened over the past year and a half, are you comfortable with that? Let's take our first call from Waltham, Massachusetts, and Sarah is with us. Hi, Sarah.
Hello, Mr. Gordon. Thank you.
Yeah.
Comment and a question. My comment is that Iraq sounds to me like a country that's just artificial. It isn't even a country. Doesn't sound to me that it ever was one. Didn't Britain do something about that after World War One? And maybe some history could help in getting all of this together in some better way. Or else we should leave and let it all fall apart and let them, now that they've had a taste of the idea of democracy, let them make three different countries. They're like three different tribes, at least three, if not more. So could you comment on this and help us think?
What's the point, Larry? Why hold it together? That's Sarah's question.
Let me say two things, Dick. First of all, there are a lot of artificial countries in the world in terms of their not having been countries at some time in the past and having been crafted in part as a result of colonial intervention. And if you're going to say now, let's break them all up or have them fall apart naturally along ethnic lines of division, you're asking for a massive surge in bloodshed and ethnic strife and civil war in countries around the world, not least Iraq. I believe there is no way that Iraq is going to break apart peacefully. First of all, oil is in only two parts of the country, mainly in the south where the Shia are, and in the Kurdish north, or really on the border in some cases between Kurdish and Sunni control. So there's going to be a massive violent battle for control of the oil resources. And there are a lot of Iraqis, I think the overwhelming majority, who believe in the idea of Iraq and in fact feel a strong sense of Iraqi nationalism. Moreover, it's a mistake to think that Iraqis identify mainly or only as Sunni, Shia, and Kurds. Many Iraqis think of their primary identity as Iraqi, and indeed there are a lot of mixed marriages in the country. So I think this is understandable but quite simplistic and dangerous thinking to presume that we can simply let or even induce this country to fall apart.
Okay, 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK is the number to join us this hour. We're going next to Williamsburg, Virginia. Hap's on the line. Hello, Hap.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling. What do you think?
Well, I think maybe we're making a mistake in trying to impose our solution to the problem.
What do you mean by our solution here, Hap?
The only way to get the Sunnis to buy in to a unified government and participating is to give them a meaningful choice. The choice would be an autonomous separate state that would not have oil revenues, but Sunni state, or buy into a unified state. I think given if they saw the choice, they'd buy into the unified state. If they don't have that choice, then they're going to resist the whole process. The way you deal with difficult situations is you give meaningful choice.
Don't you get the impression, Hap, from what we've seen over the past year and a half, that maybe there are those among the insurgents who are going, where are we headed with this? Are we making any progress?
I mean, we have to admit that there are nations that have worked after partition when there's strong religious and ethnic divisions. India, Pakistan is an immediate example. Instead of trying to force a unified state, there was partition. It wasn't a clean process, but in the end, there are two strong states that have emerged from it, and possibly Iraq. If that was the future that it chose, we should allow that meaningful choice.
Although, Hap, I think if you talk to people in India and Pakistan, they would, you know, wring their hands over the 50 years of communal violence that followed partition. But it's an interesting way of looking at it. And Larry, should it be the choice of, or could it be otherwise, the choice of the Sunnis to say, look, you're in, these are the conditions, or you're not?
I think that we are in the process of offering or framing a different choice for the Sunnis. And that is, look, we're not going to walk away, we the United States, and simply let this country sink into civil war and some renewed effort at seizure of national power by some unaccountable minority. So if you continue down this path of insurgency and violence, everyone will suffer. Nobody will gain. We are in now what political scientists call a mutually hurting stalemate. Everybody's losing, everybody's hurting, and everybody can be better off by a peaceful settlement. Therefore, we offer the other choice to Sunni insurgents, to other insurgents, to people who are unhappy with the situation, and that is a kind of compromise in which there's a sharing of power, a sharing of resources, a restoration of political order under a democratic constitutional framework, and then, and Dick, the then is very important, we leave militarily. Once it's clear that Iraq has stabilized, once there's an Iraqi army and police and other security forces that can maintain order, we indicate very clearly we are not going to seek permanent military bases. We're not going to have troops there for 50 years like in Germany and Japan. We're going at that point.
All right, 1-800-423-8255. Next to Washington, North Carolina, and Sean is with us. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Dick.
Thanks for calling. What do you think?
Hey, I've got a small problem. I'm hearing a lot of talk about insurgency and everything, and I agree we need to come up with some type of process, but the root of this is still I'm missing about Al-Qaeda. You know, we still have Al-Qaeda that started the insurgency, that gave birth to the insurgency, and all these other groups came up. We have a commitment that this administration has set and has rallied the people of this country behind in defeating Al-Qaeda, whether that be in Iraq or in Afghanistan. And I see us almost backing down and washing that under the table, kind of not talking about Al-Qaeda.
No, I think, Sean, it's an excellent point, and Larry spoke about this group earlier as the dead-enders, the people who don't have any kind of political stake in here. And so Larry, how would you ever imagine a scenario where the U.S. could say, right, okay, Iraq, you're in control of your own affairs, we'll leave, if Al-Qaeda is always going to be there with its car bombs?
Well, first of all, Dick, we have to ask ourselves, why is Al-Qaeda able to operate in Iraq? And the reason is because it is embedded in a social milieu, a set of communities that are giving it safe haven, that are enabling these foreign insurgents to operate, that are using them and to some degree sympathizing with them. We need to give those Sunni communities in Iraq an incentive to kick Al-Qaeda out, to turn on them, to turn them in, to say you're no longer welcome, or to join us in suppressing them. And then the incentive is that they get a political order in which they can rebuild their communities, their schools, their roads. The economy will revive. People will have jobs, better lives, and everybody will be better off. I think it's a mistake historically and conceptually to think that this insurgency started with Al-Qaeda. It didn't. It started with the Iraqis, who then welcomed in foreign insurgents to ally with them and fight with them, even if they were, like the former Baathists, fierce secularists. It's a temporary alliance, and it can be broken up. Our goal has to be to separate the Al-Qaeda and other foreign jihadists and the senior Baathists with blood on their hands sitting in Syria organizing and financing this insurgency from the Sunni communities who are not dead-enders, who have been sending signals that they want to talk to the United States and participate in the new political order, and who could have an interest in a peaceful and democratic Iraq.
What do you think of that, Sean?
Well, I think, you know, here in the United States, if a girlfriend of a drug dealer is found with drugs under her bed, she's arrested too and given a minimum life sentence or something. You know, these people are associating with Al-Qaeda, so why are they not as guilty as Al-Qaeda?
But rather than judge them on where they are right now, just imagine for me the scenario that Larry described, Sean, where he said, you know what, if the Sunni communities can be persuaded that they have a proper place in Iraq, maybe they'll be the ones to tell the Al-Qaeda people, the foreign jihadists, that they're not welcome, and they'll just leave. Can you see that happening?
I think it's a roll of the dice. I think that's a lot. That's giving these people who put Saddam in power a lot of leeway to say, go ahead and try to make the right decision this time. But if you don't, what's going to happen?
Larry?
Well, you know, if we get moralistic about this and say because people were involved in violence, we won't deal with them, you know, who are we going to deal with? Then the only answer is bring it on. We'll have civil war. And what we'll have in Iraq, I'm quite clear now, is a decade or more of fighting an insurgency at roughly the level we see now. I think the polls show, the very ones that you cited at the beginning of this hour, that the American people are not going to stand for an endless, purely military engagement in Iraq, that there has to be a political strategy joined to it. that offers some kind of compromise, some kind of peaceful future for the country, and therefore terms under which we can not only withdraw honorably, but withdraw in a way that will really leave a stabilized Iraq.
I have to go back to the title of your book, Squandered Victory, The American Occupation and the Bungled Effort to Bring Democracy to Iraq, and ask you just how much of a role the U.S. can and should continue to have there. Has the U.S., in your view, been now so discredited by the initial bombing and the war and the occupation that it's got no real role in the kind of political process we're describing here, Larry?
It's a very subtle and paradoxical situation, Dick, because on the one hand, Iraqis resent us. They're fed up with us, and they don't want American and international intervention, particularly, as Noah rightly said, in the making of their constitution. On the other hand, we have Iraqis who are begging us to be actually more active and more involved than we have been during the period, I think, of very considerable drift over the last few months when we've been without an American ambassador in Baghdad. Thank God we have one, and a very able one, Zalmay Khalilzad, going out there soon. So I think that if we are involved in a way that's supportive, that's mediating, that's sympathetic, that's standing behind an elected Iraqi transitional government rather than dictating to it, which we so often did during the occupation, Iraqis will welcome that, not all Iraqis, but I think the majority of Iraqis, and in particular if we're doing this in partnership with the international community. This is another very important development, that the international community has become more active. There's going to be a major international conference in Brussels in just about 10 days where many of our European allies who were not involved in the war and stood back after the war are now becoming more politically active in trying to support the post-war political process and the post-war economic reconstruction process. So I think there are some potentially positive signs here that the United States is perhaps learning some lessons.
Larry, I want to thank you for putting up with power outages and technical problems and staying with us for the hour. It's fascinating to hear from you.
I love your show, and it's a pleasure.
Larry Diamond, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution and author of Squandered Victory, The American Occupation and the Bungled Effort to Bring Democracy to Iraq. Earlier in the program, he was there with Noah Feldman, who's law professor at New York University, and Patrick McDonald, who is one of the Baghdad bureau chiefs for the Los Angeles Times. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.